KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this coming year a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Jason Ross Arnold, the author of Secrecy in the Sunshine Era, The Promise and Failures of U.S. Open Government Law. Jason is an associate professor of political science at Virginia Commonwealth University, and he has authored a epic tour of a variety of areas involving particularly governmental secrecy in 2015. The book covers a tremendous amount of material, and as regular Hearsay Culture listeners know, most of the time I'm interviewing book authors, and we can never possibly cover everything in the book or even begin to do so in a meaningful way. My goal with Hearsay Culture is to get through broad themes and to kind of dig deep into areas that I think should get more public attention, and then, let's be honest, because it's a radio station, make for good radio. In Secrecy in the Sunshine Era, Jason covers everything from institutional secrecy in the executive branch to secrecy in the use of scientific evidence by government to the burning, shredding, and deletion of documents, the tried-and-true way of keeping secrets from the public. The book, because it covers so much material, gives a tremendous food for thought aspect to it. And as I was reading the book, I made a lot of notations for myself in terms of areas that we could dig into, which Jason does talk about towards the end of the book in terms of what to do with all this information. So we're going to talk a bit towards the end of the interview about how we confront these issues. Secrecy is an area which we've covered increasingly on Hearsay Culture, primarily because it has two broad themes that I think are of particular or should be of particular interest to Hearsay Culture listeners. The first is the procedural aspects of secrecy, the ability of secrecy to control information access that the public might want, that policymakers need, that lawyers might want, involving broad technological and IP law-related issues that Hearsay Culture was founded on dealing with. If we don't know what is going on inside our policymaking arenas, for a variety of reasons, it is difficult for us as the public to understand what is going on. On the other hand, secrecy plays an important role in decision-making, and so there are serious and legitimate needs for secrecy in, for example, the negotiation of trade agreements. On the other hand, how much secrecy is too much? These are questions which are largely unresolved, but they're the kinds of issues from a procedural standpoint that Hearsay Culture listeners, I think, should be interested in. But there is also a substantive angle of secrecy. And a lot of times we equate sometimes secrecy with privacy. Sometimes we equate secrecy with control of information. And it is that, but it is, I think, something different as well. And so secrecy is a substantive way to deal with issues ranging from, right, anonymous speech to the ability of people to control when information is shared with governments or with corporations, has another aspect and a second aspect of this question of secrecy that I think is broadly important in our understanding of technological and tech policy and law. And so in Secrecy in the Sunshine Era, what I think Jason has contributed more than anything else is a root base understanding of what secrecy looks like across a broad spectrum today. And so in Secrecy in a Sunshine Era, we are going to be talking today about a variety of those areas, but first kind of defining what we mean by secrecy today and what secrecy might mean for us going forward. Again, Jason Ross Arnold is an associate professor of political science at Virginia Commonwealth University. Secrecy in a Sunshine Era, published very recently by the University Press of Kansas. Jason is joining us on July 7th, 2015 from Richmond, Virginia via Skype. Jason, thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So Jason, let's start off with a broad question that I ask most of my guests. Tell us a bit more about your background and why you chose to write this book now.
Well, I mean, how far back do you want to go? I guess I could.
Yeah, you know, whatever you think is relevant. We can start with birth if you'd like. We have time on the show, so go for it.
I'll try to jump over some of the less meaningful episodes.
Okay. Appreciate it.
I was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois, and with regard to these kinds of topics, I guess I could say my first related or relevant interest came about with the some of the efforts, especially in the mid to late 80s, when either government officials, politicians, or other Washington elites were making some efforts, probably well-intentioned efforts to place warnings on record labels, or try to guide parents to keep kids from listening to profane music. I'm thinking about Tipper Gore's efforts and Senator Gore's efforts to sort of get the discussion started about censorship or censorship-related issues. I got interested in that. I got interested in sort of the flag-burning debates that were happening back then. And so I always kind of had an interest in the way in which elites especially try to restrict the flow of information. I guess it was focused a lot on government and politics, but at that point I was more interested in sort of the popular cultural side of it. When I sort of moved my way through school and then eventually graduate school, I got really interested in the problem of public ignorance and why does it seem like voters don't know a lot about politics? Is that a particularly American problem? How do we compare with other countries in the world? And then looking at the causes of that and then looking at the consequences. What does it mean? What kinds of problems do we have when people don't really know who they're voting for, don't really keep up with the issues? I try to get a sense of the scale and scope of the problem. And so that consumed my work and my interest for a lot of years. And then a couple of years after that, I started to get really interested in the WikiLeaks issue and some of the, I guess, Obama-era whistleblowing controversies. Some of it also from the Bush-Cheney era, looking at the secret legal memos, the torture memos, and some of those kinds of issues. But what really captured my attention was that just the emergence of WikiLeaks as a phenomenon in 2010 mostly. And so what really happened there was I was just sort of fascinated with the story, but sort of my social scientific self, I began to ask, these kinds of questions. What kinds of secrets should stay secret? Was it a problem that Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, sent Julian Assange or WikiLeaks those kinds of secrets? And I just began to think about those issues and sort of in an effort to bring this into research, I began a project looking at freedom of information laws and related issues around the world. I got started writing that book, decided I'd first focus on the United States as one of many cases, started writing that chapter. It started to blossom into two chapters, and then I guess kept going with that. And so the book became singularly focused on the United States.
Which certainly we have plenty of secrecy to discuss in our country, much
exactly.
less the rest of the world.
It was hard to stop because there was so much to write about.
That's right. Let me ask you this, Jason. So the title of the book is "Secrecy in the Sunshine Era." The subtitle: "The Promise and Failures of U.S. Open Government Laws," and it implies what I think is a broad theme in the book, which is, and you pose it, kind of this way, in an era where we have transparency touted as a core governmental value, even though it's not always been that, and in an era where information access is king via the internet and newer technologies, How is it that we have excessive secrecy? And so in that vein, when we use the word secrecy, as I mentioned in my introduction, there's lots of definitions. How do you define secrecy for purposes of the book?
Well, I mean, for me, it's fairly simple. For me, secrecy is, it's exclusive information, people having exclusive knowledge. We seem to always turn our attention to the national security arena when thinking about the subject. And of course, there's plenty of secrecy there, and there are many interesting discussions to be had about that. But I began to think about all the other parts of the government where we find this kind of excessive secrecy, and I guess we should unpack what I mean by excessive. We don't all agree what that would mean, especially in this subject. But basically, the reason why I speak about excessive secrecy is because I acknowledge, like almost everybody else, that some secrecy is necessary in government for many different reasons, for reasons of national security, for law enforcement operations, to protect personal privacy. There are many reasons why you mentioned trade negotiations too, and so there are many different categories where we can imagine where we'd want our government to keep secrets. And so there are some necessary secrets, but as probably almost all of your listeners know, there seems to be a lot of unnecessary secrecy when it's excessive. Even in those same categories. So one of the more entertaining examples comes from one of the most commonly cited reasons for keeping secrets: troop movements in wars. You're waging a war, you want to keep your strategy under wraps. You don't want the adversary to know where you are, where you're going, and so forth. Right. So one of the more obvious examples of necessary secrets is troop movements during war. So Geraldo Rivera, famously enough, and I think it was in probably late March 2003 or maybe early April, he was embedded with troops in Iraq, and I think it was on live national television on Fox News. He started drawing a sand diagram of where he and the troops were located, sort of as on a map in Iraq. And he told viewers, we're outside of the city and we're headed in this direction. Right. So he clearly made an error. Like, very few people would think that. That's the kind of information that we should just always disclose. So troop movements in a hot war, that seems to be a clear example of a necessary secret. But there are there's information about troop movements from wars from long ago. So one another kind of famous, but I guess less famous example, because it doesn't involve Geraldo Rivera, is in World War I, of course, there were documents showing troop movements and troop locations, and during that war, it made sense for the government to keep that information secret. But for decades and decades, the government decided that this was too sensitive to disclose. It took a very assertive effort by Steve Aftergood of the Federation of American Scientists, and I think it was the early 1990s, to take the government to court for them to release these World War One era troop movement documents, and they still didn't get everything. So the same category, troop movements, related to military issues. We could see why it would make sense for the government to keep secrets sometimes, but obviously not always.
As I mentioned in the introduction, at least from a technology perspective, secrecy is obviously operates within this broad question of how information flows between consumers and government, and between the private sector and government and the like. broadly speaking, before we dig into some of the specific examples that you have in the book, you know, what do you think is our general understanding, and our, by that I mean the public's really, general understanding of the nature of secrecy in the context of information flow? In other words, how much do we really think about, do you think, as a public, information that we don't have? Now, I know that that's a broad question, but the reason I ask it is, there's a certain amount of conditioning that seems to have gone on around privacy, meaning, right, there's a lot of people who now believe, I think very sincerely, that privacy as a concept is gone. Certainly, it's a somewhat reasonable, I think, conclusion based upon what we know, as you alluded to, through WikiLeaks and also through the Snowden revelations about how government is accessing information. Do you feel the same way about secrecy? In other words, is secrecy also something that we just have to accept? We're simply never going to know everything, not only that we shouldn't know, but that we'd like to know?
Hmm. Well, I think, as I suggested earlier, I think most people would concede that there are some things that they're not going to know, and you know, most people are okay with that. But I think as you know, more of these you know, as Snowdens and Mannings and, you know, earlier Ellsbergs and other sort of you know, break the barrier and release, you know, pages upon pages of documents that that the government once held close, people wonder, you know, well, you know, to what extent should the government have kept this information secret? What kinds of things should we know? And so, you know, it's not like everyone's going to agree about, you know, what the borderline should be or how big the barrier should be. But I think you're right that with you know, technological development, and there's this, you know, there's information all around, and, you know, people can find out about, you know, seemingly virtually anything that they want at the click of a button. It seems like people have a sort of a greater appetite for having more information. I don't know the extent to which that's changing our perceptions about, you know, what they should have access to and what not. I don't know the extent to which people sort of think about it in those abstract terms. But I do think that when there are episodes like the Snowden disclosures, when people learn about specific government programs, collecting their call information, collecting their internet activities, people want to know, you know, what exactly is the government doing with this? You know, what should they do and should they not? So I guess I'm not sure I answered your question, it seems to me that most people that I interact with don't tend to think about it in abstract terms. But when, you know, when there are concrete examples to chew through, people tend to have attitudes that seem to favor more disclosure. Even people, you know, people on the right, people on the left, seem to share a bias towards disclosure. And there's widespread agreement that, you know, certainly not everybody agrees, but there seems to be a lot of agreement that the government needs to be more transparent.
We're chatting with Jason Ross Arnold, professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, author of the book Secrecy in the Sunshine Era, The Promise and Failures of U.S. Open Government Laws, on KZSU-FM Stanford. Jason, yeah, you know, I purposely asked that question in a somewhat theoretical and abstract way, because I, at least this is my sense, and I base it on the kinds of discussions we've had on hearsay culture. There seems to be a much more developed, even theoretical and abstract understanding of privacy as a public interest than there is secrecy. But I think your book, as I mentioned in the introduction, makes a valuable contribution in our understanding of the contours of secrecy today. And therefore, the nature of the question is as much drawn from the broader concern about what secrecy is and whether we even know what secrets should look like, as opposed to, at least in the technological sector, I think, much more deep and rich understanding of privacy interests. So perhaps I'll ask you to question this way, or at least ask you to question as a follow-up. As you alluded to, we have what you might call necessary secrets and unnecessary secrets. And you've also, and I did, and you amplified it, right, brought up national security as a prototype of kind of a less controversial, if you will, type of secret as opposed to others. Is secrecy an end unto itself? And I ask that question because a lot of times when we think about tech policy and information flow issues, it goes back to, you know, historical writing on the nature of power, right? One who has information that others want is in a more powerful position. And it would seem like government, in particular, since that is your focus, also operates that way. There's a sense of control, if you will, over a population if the government possesses information that the public might want, even if that information ultimately is not that valuable. So do you view, as you've looked at all of these different aspects of secrecy, some of which we will dig into in a moment, but to ask the broad question, do you see secrecy as being an end unto itself in current government operations?
I think, yeah, it certainly can be, and it often is. I think that there are lots of different causes for excessive secrecy. So you named one of them. This, mm-hmm. Secrecy is in and of itself, and this relates to, as you pointed out, this sort of, you know, constant, enduring sort of power-seeking element of bureaucracies. You know, bureaucracies, government agencies, they want to hoard information. They do it for a lot of different reasons. They do it to so they can, you know, be distinct within the huge government bureaucracy. If you have all the same information, you're churning out the same kinds of reports as, you know, the other agency across the street, there's probably not much use for you. And so, you know, in the never-ending quest for a slice of the budgetary pie, you know, you're going to want to have a separate set of secrets, of information, so you can endure. So part of it is just sort of the elusive quest for power, but that's, you know, but that power is instrumental. The power, you know, it's a bureaucratic interest in a lot of ways for the bureaucracy to survive and grow, as well as to, you know, avoid criticism. You don't want too much coming out about your own activities, because then some of that will be called into question. So, but there are many other reasons, I think, for why we have excessive secrecy. You know, even within the bureaucracy, there's a kind of bureaucratic conservatism, a risk aversion that, you know, runs deep throughout most kinds of bureaucracies. Bureaucrats, you know, information officers in this instance, they have a lot of uncertainty about the information policy choices that they make, because, you know, what happens, you know, if something is sort of on the borderline, you know, maybe this is too sensitive, you know, what if I release this? You know, the bureaucracy will suffer, I will suffer, I'll get fired, right? So there's this kind of better safe than sorry element to these bureaucratic choices. And then the other part of the bureaucracy, too, is that they just don't have a lot of resources. There are just not enough people going through these huge stacks of files to determine what should be released and what should not. And so I think people just have a bias toward secrecy because you know, they don't want to make a mistake. And so they've got these huge, towering stacks of files sitting on their desk. There's going to be another delivery of stacks tomorrow, and so they just have to go quickly through it. And so, you know, if we had ironically enough, more bureaucrats making these decisions, maybe it would be less of a problem, but then we would still run up against the risk aversion. But, you know, lots of other reasons too. You know, people don't want to be embarrassed. Maybe officials make mistakes. Maybe the government did something that they should not have had. Imagine that. And we don't want that information to come out. You know, there are plenty of people who have served in the government that says, like, they say that, you know, this is a pretty substantial portion of the secrecy, embarrassment avoidance. There's, you know, lax enforcement. So, you know, Obama and other presidents have come into power saying, you know, we're going to make big changes. We're going to force the bureaucrats to become less risk averse. You know, let's presume disclosure. But then when push comes to shove, they don't enforce those kinds of changes. And then there's another never-ending force, which is interest group power. The agencies work very closely with business groups, other kinds of groups. You know, sometimes there's, you know, what political scientists call agency capture, and business interests often have an interest in keeping things secret, stuff about their business or their industry more generally. And so those are all like sort of never-ending constant forces of excessive secrecy, but then there are lots of variable ones too, and I guess we can get into that if you'd like.
Well, you know what? You have opened us up to lots of inquiry that would make this a 5-hour interview. But I would be remiss, Jason, if I didn't say yes, please continue. What are those broader or more indirect forces at work that encourage the excessive secrecy that you're concerned about?
Right. So with all those constant forces, you know, I see this as like a problem that will never be firmly resolved. You know, that all of those things will continue to happen, and we could tamp it down, but those forces will continue. But then we have other things, you know, exogenous events like the 9/11 attack. All of a sudden, there's this huge, unexpected terrorist attack that, you know, for a lot of years, people were saying, this changes everything, this changes everything. And, you know, it basically what it created was this critical juncture in American politics where people were thinking deeply about, you know, so many of the ways in which we approach these kinds of issues, counterterrorism, counterintelligence, the balance between liberty and security and so forth. And so these kinds of shocks to the system could sort of change the balance towards secrecy, away from transparency. But then there are also, you know, administration by administration, more endogenous or, you know, inside changes that happen. And so, you know, some of it could be ideological. Bush-Cheney administration was famously, you know, and deeply committed sincerely toward greater executive secrecy. This was part of their governing ideology. You know, they saw it, you know, they cited the Federalist Papers and Hamilton. You know, they traced it back to, you know, Bush-Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld's experiences in the Nixon and Ford White Houses in the 1970s and how Congress tried to push the government too far in the other direction. So there could be ideological reasons. And then tactical moves, too, by officials, some with a greater appetite for this, tactical moves for them to circumvent the open government laws. You know, so something happens, there could be some conflict where people say, wait a minute, weren't those task force meetings supposed to be open to the public? Weren't you supposed to publish transcripts? And so, you know, another example from the Bush administration would be the Cheney's Energy Task Force, or about a decade before that, Hillary Clinton's healthcare task force. And, you know, they basically operated directly against the letter and spirit of one of the Sunshine Laws. It's the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And in response, they just pulled out all the stops. They tried to redefine words in the law. So, for example, Hillary Clinton's healthcare task force in 93 She said that all of the private sector interests who were meeting to discuss the policy were actually not members of the task force, but they were really consultants, and therefore this law didn't kick in because just the way they redefined the participants. The Bush-Cheney administration did something very similar. And so there are all these word games that administrations play. They play games with the court system, different things that they do to avoid the obligations that they have with these sunshine laws. And so this isn't necessarily a constant force, a constant cause of excessive secrecy, but this is more directly related to the choices of officials and their appetite for secrecy.
We're chatting with Professor Jason Ross Arnold of VCU, author of the book Secrecy in the Sunshine Era, The Promise and Failures of U.S. Open Government Laws, on KZSU-FM Stanford. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. So, Jason, you know, I was actually, you know, as part of how I do the interviews, I will take notes as I'm writing and as we're talking to make sure that I do follow-up questions and structure the interview as I choose. I counted 9 reasons that you went through for secrecy inside government. And now I'm going to ask you kind of the counterpoint question, which is not how do we solve this. We'll get to that in a moment. You know, and as you indicated, there may not be a solution to it, but we can talk about at least some ways to approach it. But let me ask you the flip side question. You've given us the reasons, a broad, terrific list of reasons why government would engage in excessive secrecy. Would you or can you identify perhaps, and I'm not going to ask you for 9 elements on this list as well, but maybe what you think of as the 2 or 3 strongest countervailing forces that currently exist, not that you would have happen, but that currently exist that push against this. For example, right, if we have open government laws but they aren't enforced, you might suggest that that isn't really much of a force at all pushing against this. So are there forces that exist aside from, and maybe I'm loading the question here, aside from the existence of WikiLeaks, or that alone may be a force against it, that push against all of these currents?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, we could start with what we have. These, you know, at the time that they were enacted, at least, these kind of radical laws, you know, that for the first time, you know, there were some previous laws in the books that told the government it had to disclose things, but the 1970s sunshine laws, as I'm sort of putting them together as, were radical in the sense that they said citizens have a right to demand information from the government. Citizens have a right to read about, watch the interactions between government officials and private sector interests, and so forth. Citizens have a right to know about the files that the government has kept on them. This is the Privacy Act. Citizens have a right to, you know, go through the presidential papers after some period of time. So we're starting with a nice set of laws that, you know, as we pointed out, are sometimes work really well, and I don't want to paint too dire a picture for readers or for the audience. And a lot of the time, these are still very powerful laws, and the government, in a lot of ways, is in our society, in a lot of ways, is so far better off for having them. They're not enforced really well. There are all these ways in which officials try to get around them. What can we do? Well, part of it is strengthening the checks and balances. And this is so, it's almost platitudinous to say that, right? We've got this problem in the executive branch. Let's just say, what, let's have Congress in the courts step up their act.
Can I interrupt you though?
Say that.
No, it is. I want to interrupt you though because that is a follow-up question I want to ask. But I want to ask you what I think is a maybe a harder question. If I've interrupted you and you were going this direction, then my apologies. But without regard to what we might fix, in terms of if we do nothing at all about this, okay, we as the public, right? So we don't change laws. We don't put pressure on. Are there any existing forces or elements or currents that exist today without us changing anything that you think push against this? So I don't mean that's why I kind of excluded WikiLeaks. I don't mean, well, you know, you can solve secrecy by having Julian Assange get his hands on everything and clearly just put it all out there. But are there forces that are already at play, already at work, that you think are pushing against this?
I guess I'm a little pessimistic about that. I mean, I see a lot of potential. I see that more and more people are becoming really interested in these issues. Especially after the Snowden disclosures, but also after the big WikiLeaks disclosures, so there seems to be a greater interest in this subject, which might then channel into electoral politics increasingly, or even protests in the streets. It's hard to see how that would happen. Big protests about something abstract like government secrecy, but. On these particular issues, about Snowden or Manning or something of that sort, maybe some kind of civic action would do the trick. But I do think that I'm mildly optimistic about our institutions. Still, I don't see them as corroded to the core. There's a lot of corrosion. But I do think that with enough of that sort of push from below, whether with regard to voters or protesters, even internet activism, then we could even push the agencies to do a better job of enforcing the laws that we already have in the books. So let me give you one example. A lot of the bureaucrats, the information officers making these choices about whether to step something as secret or not, they often, at least the ones dealing with classified information, they get reviewed or they get audited, some of them at least, for their adherence to the classification guidelines. So there's always this thing hanging over their heads that if they don't follow the guidelines well enough, then it's going to affect their career. They won't get promoted, they won't get a raise, or something like that. I think that we could use something like that to force information officers to follow the guidelines. So Obama came in, said we're gonna have a new presumption of openness with regard to Freedom of Information Act administration. And if the information officers had their annual reviews based on random audits of whether or not they were following that law, following the rule, excuse me, then I think we'll get probably better results. That, in addition to reforms in the Congress, there's a FOIA reform still surviving somehow in the Congress. It's not fully passed yet.
And I do want to ask you about that, so go ahead, yeah.
Sure, yeah. And so, I think that a combination of institutional action and citizen action is our best bet. That's totally abstract, also kind of a platitude, but, that'll do it. And I do think that new statutes are needed as well. So I talked about that example of Hillary Clinton's healthcare task force and then Cheney's energy task force twisting the words around with regard to the people in the task forces. They're not members of the task force. They're consultants or visitors. And by doing that, they were able to just get around the law. If Congress passed statutes that tried to narrow down all that ambiguity, or if they precisely defined what a member was, then I think we'd be better off. And so much of the problem to me, this was something I found really interesting as I was working on the book, so much of the problem involves interpretation and the executive branch somehow accumulating all of this interpretive power. They thrive on these ambiguities. And so I think there's a movement within your profession, the legal profession, mm-hmm. clear statement regimes or something to that effect, mm-hmm. Where I don't know if it's exactly relevant, but I think it's close, where there's this push to sort of demand more clarity and less ambiguity in statutes, then there would be less wiggle room for officials to try to circumvent these laws. So, I don't know if I answered your question, but it's this combination of institutional action and citizen action.
No, I think, I'll put it this way, Jason. I think, I asked you a somewhat unfair question, which I do from time to time, because you had previously said that you weren't sure that any of this was ever fully solvable. And then I asked you, okay, well, what forces are going to solve it? So, no, I think you did answer what was a somewhat unfair question. That last point on ambiguity, I think, is a very interesting one. Because words, of course, themselves, and I teach contracts, any word I tell my students can be rendered ambiguous. The students that really want to have fun say, "Really, Professor Levine?" And they try to push back, and we can find ambiguities. That's the nature of language. But of course, what you're talking about here is not genuine or legitimate questions about the meaning of words, but manipulation of words, which is, I think, different for a particular end. Let me ask you a couple of questions by way of follow up that I think tie to these broad issues involving information and ambiguity and what we do with information in the context of secrecy. In several places in the book, you talk about mosaic theory, or what we might think about as data aggregation. The ability of governments, of the private sector, to bring disparate pieces of information together and draw inferences and conclusions that you wouldn't otherwise be able to draw with an individual piece of data. And as I alluded to earlier, a lot of focus here is on privacy and the ability through data aggregation to unmask the identities of individuals or at least get data about them. What is the role of these functions, mosaic theory, which you may want to define in your answer, or data aggregation in the operation of secrecy?
Sure. Well,
and by the way, I should say we have about 10 minutes left, so we are in the unfair portion of the show officially, where I ask you questions that you don't have time to answer adequately. So with that, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'll do my best. mosaic theory is... it's related to, what did you say, data aggregation? Right, but its use is sort of more particular in government. So here's what mosaic theory is. It's this idea that, in this context at least, that even seemingly innocuous, unclassified information, so this is stuff that isn't classified, maybe sensitive. This seemingly, innocent information, if you have a clever adversary who can sort of take these bits, these pieces of the mosaic, and put them together, that adversary might be able to make it into some kind of coherent whole that looks a lot like something the government might classify. So there's a real worry that even if we put out this unclassified information, at least enough of it, then somebody might be able to piece it together and do some damage with it. And it's something that's been around. This mosaic theory has been around since at least the 1940s. I mean, Truman wrote about it. Eisenhower. In their executive orders about classification, but it really didn't become something that people really worried about until much, much later. So later on in the Cold War, they decided that a lot of officials at least decided that they needed to be more risk averse about this kind of information. And there were, you know, there were instances where, you know, their worries were maybe validated. And so one example, which is not about an adversary, but about the Progressive magazine, also clever, but not an adversary, at least not in the way that people usually think about with enemies. But anyway, in the late 1970s, one of the journalists working for the Progressive somehow pieced together all of this, this nuclear information that the government decided wasn't sensitive enough to be classified, and therefore accessible to people like him. So Howard Moreland, in 1979, wrote this story called "The H-Bomb Secret: How We Got It, Why We're Telling It," and he found all this information from employee recruitment brochures, environmental impact statements, you know, books, articles, interviews, and he basically was able to publish a guide to the design of a hydrogen bomb, and this was all pieced together from unclassified information. And so, you know, it turned into this court case, and there was a court injunction, forced the Progressive from delaying publication. Eventually, some local paper published it, and, you know, it came out anyway. But it was, it's one example of how these fears of mosaic builders actually are sometimes, they could be real fears, meaning, like, people could actually do this. And so you see this in the way that the Bush administration, after 9/11, held information about the people they swept up in the Pent Bomb investigation, the big internal investigation that the FBI did to look for sympathizers with Al Qaeda, people planning attacks, people in cells. And so there are all these you know, these detentions, and the government refused to even let information about the individuals or the trials from getting out because of this mosaic theory. And so it's, you know, we can see how it makes sense. There are these, you know, like that Progressive story, these cases where people were able to do it. But it's probably increasingly difficult, as you pointed out, in an era with you know, so much information available to people. You know, previously, so back in the 1970s, this Progressive journalist was, you know, had to go to, you know, far-flung libraries and, you know, government agencies to get their employee recruitment brochures. Now it's much more easily done. And so maybe the risk is even greater, but then the temptation to clamp down probably also increases.
We're chatting with Professor Jason Ross Arnold, author of the book Sunshine and the Secret. There we go. I'm butchering it. I wish it was, that was the case. Secrecy in the Sunshine Era on KZSU FM Stanford. Maybe that was just hopeful thinking. In light of what I think is the last question I'm going to ask you, Jason, because I want to give you time on it, because I cut you off on this earlier. Now that, you know, this is a wonderful book and there's so much information in it, we have barely touched the tip of the various examples of the kinds of secrets that you're concerned about in the book. But let me ask you this question. So, even though this is an intractable problem, what can we do to address it? I had cut you off earlier in answering that question. Now I'll ask you, in about the 5 minutes we have left, what would you propose as ways that we could approach these problems?
So, I mean, one thing that I haven't mentioned, too, is just, and this is what I guess motivated me to dig so deep and to try to uncover as many of these stories is to point out the absurdities and to try to you know, sort of shout about these absurdities from the rooftops. And so, you know, some of these issues related to national security are trickier because the sensitivity of the information you know, often makes these morsels of information kind of borderline cases. You know, maybe we can see why they would want to keep it secret, especially with things like mosaic theory in mind. But then a big chunk of the book that we did not talk about yet is the secret science. Mm-hmm. And this was what I found the sort of most interesting and what made me the angriest as I was working on it, because the excuses made were just ridiculous. With issues that had nothing to do with the military or national security, even privacy, where we see the business power element come into play more and more. So in addition to the things that I mentioned before, push the reforms already underway, demand statutes with greater clarity and less ambiguity, greater electoral pressure in between elections, greater citizen pressure too, and whistleblowing from time to time, we should try to shine a light on what's already in the public domain. I mean, you can only do so much because of all the secrecy, but because of whistleblowers, because of lawsuits, because of other things, we do have this information out there, and if we try to broadcast as far as possible to make as many people see it as possible, that all of these absurd tales of overclassification or of concealing, information about antibiotic-resistant bacteria emanating from Iowa hog farms, to take one example, I think more and more people will understand that this is actually a problem. It's not only about these borderline cases related to national security, but it's this larger problem in all of these other domains that demand some more attention. So, publication, exposure, legal changes, citizen pressure, better checks and balances, less deference by judges, even in the national security realm, when it's called for, at least. These together could help us turn the corner.
You had alluded to, and I'll do a quick follow-up here, Jason, in 2 minutes or so we have left. You had alluded to earlier some of the FOIA reforms, which, as you noted, are somehow still floating around, and there are majority member senators who are actually behind it, which may be the political reason why it's there. Who do you see as the leaders at a national level among elected officials in dealing with these secrecy issues? Who do you think are the most thoughtful or the most likely to get stuff done, if anyone?
Well, for a long time, Senator Wyden from Oregon, Democratic senator, has been doing, I guess, what he considered to be possible, given his position, to warn people about the secret interpretation of the Patriot Act and other, especially national security related issues, but I do see some movement on the other side of the aisle too, and it's not the case that these leaders are always, in my opinion, making the right points and making the right arguments, but sort of as a general force, I think they could be helpful. So, Rand Paul, I certainly don't agree with him about everything, but he seems to be trying to step into the front of the lines on this issue, these pro-secrecy and less surveillance kinds of policy choices. Another Republican, another person I don't necessarily agree with about everything, but what is his name? Justin Amash, I think, and from Michigan. Most of the people historically who have pushed hardest on this issue have been Democrats, but what's interesting to me now is that there's some convergence, at least sort of on the some of the more radical sides of the ideological spectrum, kind of coming together to make these points. So I don't know. I guess I mentioned a couple more recent ones. Senator Feingold from Wisconsin was, when he was in power, he took this very seriously. Sometimes Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont. There are a lot of them, surprisingly, I suppose.
Well, it is definitely, I think good to hear you say that we're not, we're not ruined by virtue of our elected officials from dealing with this issue. Secrecy in the Sunshine Era, The Promise and Failures of U.S. Open Government Laws, the author Jason Ross Arnold of VCU. Thank you so much for joining us today on the show, Jason. Like I alluded to a few times, I mean, this could be a multi-hour series of interviews. Alas, we don't have have that much time, but I do invite you back on the show to continue these discussions, and thank you for sharing this valuable work with my listeners.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
There are a number of guests coming up on this somewhat truncated quarter of KZSU's Hearsay Culture schedule, as I mentioned on other shows, and I've posted because of writing requirements that I have, and the fact that if I don't write my articles, no one else will. I'm doing a few fewer interviews this summer, much to my regret, as I balance out the various responsibilities I have. Having said that, there are a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture's schedule about which I'm excited. Among them are included Wendell Wallach of Yale, author of the book A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control. Natasha Dow Schull, author of the book Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas. Professor Jackie Lipton of Akron Law, author of the book Rethinking Cyber Law. Margo Kaminsky of Ohio State University College of Law on International Trade and Surveillance, and rounding out this quarter, Lorelei Kelly on decision-making inside government. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture this quarter, Fridays, 3 p.m. Pacific Time on KZSU by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show by going to the Stanford CIS page at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, by going to the iTunes page for CIS, or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 230 shows as well as the upcoming schedule of guests. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com or by going to the contact page at hearsayculture.com. Thank you for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.